There's certainly no shortage of problems that we have to deal with, difficulties that the devil throws in our path from time to time. I think one of the challenges of living a Christian life in this world is trying to tend to all of the various needs that there are without getting so concerned about some that we forget about others. The devil certainly fights on more than one front at a time. We can make a long list of specific problems, very practical problems that we have to deal with in these days. But I think if anybody asks me, Gary, what really is the worst problem? What's the biggest issue? I think I would say, though many people would say this is not a very practical thing to say, I would say that it's a failure to show reverence to God as we ought to. And I want to think with you for a few minutes this evening about the need for us to try to recover a true sense of reverence toward God. And I'm not just talking about those folks out there, maybe that don't even believe in God and don't see any need to try to be reverent toward God. I'm talking about those of us who are His people and who do not relate ourselves as seriously to God as we ought to sometimes. Paul really put his finger on the heart of the issue, I think, in Romans chapter 1, verses 20 and 21, when he said, "The creation of the world, since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." And then verse 21, he says, "Although they knew God, they did not glorify Him as God, nor were they thankful. But they became futile in their hearts, and their foolish hearts were darkened." Whoever it is that Paul's talking about here, he said the problem wasn't that they didn't know there was a God, but that knowing God in some sense, they refused to treat Him as God. They refused to relate to Him with the reverence that ought to be due to God if He does exist. The question of whether there is a God is about the most important question the human being can consider. Close right behind that would be the question, if there is a God, what ought to be our attitude toward Him? What ought we to do about God? But if there is no God, then the second question is a non-issue. We have to worry about that if there is no God. But if there is, that makes a huge difference. That's not just a little tidbit of truth that's somewhat important. That's really the most important question in the entire world. And in Psalm chapter 10, psalmist talked about a particular kind of person who acts as if he didn't have to even take God into his account. I don't know in Psalm 10 if he's talking about the theoretical atheist, you know, the philosopher who's decided that there's not any God and he's going to, you know, write a book trying to convert people to atheism, or if he's talking about the person, like I think many people in the world who might say, well, yes, there is a God, but they turn right around and live their lives as if that didn't make any practical difference. Psalm 10, verse 5 begins the description of this person. "His ways are always prospering. Your judgments are far above, out of His sight. As for all His enemies, He sneers at them. He has said in his heart, 'I shall not be moved. I shall never be in adversity.' His mouth is full of cursing and deceit and oppression. Under his tongue is trouble and iniquity. He sits in the lurking places of the villages, in the secret places. He murders the innocent. His eyes are secretly fixed on the helpless. He lies in wait secretly as a lion in his den. He lies in wait to catch the poor. He catches the poor when he draws him into his net. So he crouches, he lies low, that the helpless may fall by his strength." Verse 11, "He has said in his heart, 'God has forgotten. He hides his face. He will never see it.' Arise, O Lord," the psalmist said, "O God, lift up your hand. Do not forget the humble. Why do the wicked renounce God? He has said in his heart, 'You will not require an account.'" I said, I believe he's talking here not about the theoretical atheist, but the practical atheist. The person who just defies God by the way he lives his life, as you see, he engages in wickedness as if he were not going to have to give any account. If there is a God, let him just try to stop me from doing what I want to do. And so he goes ahead and just plows through life without any respect or real reverence for the God that he might say he thinks exists. I'm afraid that's the situation of very many people in our day. And it would be a terrible thing if, as the Lord's people, we were to live anywhere close to that kind of a way, not showing respect to the God that we say we believe in. On an average day, how reverently do we relate ourselves to God? The people that you know, the people that you live in their neighborhood and you work with them, how often does the average person even think about God, do you think? Maybe on Sunday if they go to church. But in practical terms, how much difference does God make in the life of most people? Well, the obvious answer would be not much. And the tragedy is that in the case of too many religious people, I'm talking about church-going people. They're there every Sunday morning at least, if not any more than that. They deplore the fact that this country is going to the dogs and that atheism is on the rise, but they turn right around and live their lives all the other 6 days of the week really in defiance of God, treating him with the worst kind of insult, which is the insult of saying they don't believe they even have to take him into consideration. He just doesn't make very much difference. Well, we need to do better than that. Our ability even to think about God and to relate ourselves to him with what we would call reverence, the ability to do that is a characteristic that we have that sets us apart from all the lower creatures. Ecclesiastes 3 verse 11, the writer says that God has set eternity in our hearts. At least that's the way that's rendered in some translations. And that's an interesting concept, isn't it? That God not only created us, but in creating us, he planted within us some kind of a need for him, some instinct that causes us to reach out to something that's higher than us, planted within us a dissatisfaction for anything in this world. He created us with needs that can't be satisfied with anything except himself. And so God put those characteristics in our minds and in our hearts. People typically tend toward some kind of a worship, some kind of an acknowledgement of the fact that this physical, mechanical, material universe can't be all there is. There's too many things that can't be explained if this is all there is. Reading a book just in the last couple of weeks written by Lisa Miller, who is the religion editor at Newsweek magazine. It's a book that she's written on the history of heaven, the history of the idea of heaven as it has developed over the centuries. And at the end of the book, she has a very frank section where she talks about her own convictions about God. And she honestly admits that she really doesn't believe there is a God in any kind of personal sense. But she's frank to admit that she believes there is a mystery, as she uses the word, about this universe. There are just too many amazing things that call for awe and just a deep sense of our inadequacy even to explain this universe. And she said, to me, that's God, that mystery of creation, as she calls it, although she doesn't believe a personal God created this universe. She struggles in her honesty to admit that there's more to this world than can be explained by the scientist, and yet she doesn't want to say that that's a personal God. She just wants to think of that in terms of a great mystery, of some abstract kind of a wonder that we have when we contemplate the world in which we live in. Well, she is being very honest when she admits that as a human being, when she looks at the starry heavens and when she thinks seriously about what's here, that there's much about it that we just would have to stand in awe of. Well, I believe God planted within us that tendency to be awed by his creation. The tragedy is that we don't see the obvious place that all that's going, and as Paul says in Romans 1, that the things that have been made call for us to acknowledge that they've been created by God. It's amazing to me that people like Lisa Miller, who stand in awe of the universe and believe that the mystery of life needs to be worshipped, and she would put that in quotation marks, can't see that the ability even to think about that is a remarkable thing that you can't explain if we just evolve from lower forms of life. The ability to have something even remotely called reverence ought to tell us something, not only about ourselves, but about the God from whom we surely must have come. Paul, in Acts chapter 17, when he's talking to the philosophers in that city about the concept of God, he said, "Your own poets have acknowledged that we are the offspring of God." And what Paul argues there is that we know some things about ourselves. We know we are personal beings, and Paul argues that if we are the offspring of God, then God can't be anything less than what we are. If we came from Him, then the greater doesn't come from the lesser. And so God must at least be a personal being. He can't be a block of stone that you would carve and bow down before. He's got to at least be some kind of a personal creator. And since He is, He gave us the ability to acknowledge Him and to give respect and awe and reverence to Him. It's common for us to deplore the decline of reverence in people's speech these days. And I share that concern. In fact, I think that's a big concern. I don't think that's all there is to the subject of reverence. We do need to speak more respectfully of God and be more careful in our use even of the word God. Reverence goes a lot deeper than our words, but I think our words are very revealing, aren't they? There's a sense in which our words are a thermometer to our character. That is, our words to a certain extent will reveal what's in our character, just as a thermometer will tell you what's the temperature in the room. But there is also a sense in which our words can be somewhat of a thermostat that can regulate what's in our character. Most of us understand that if you want to start thinking a certain way, one of the best things you can do is start talking that way, and your words tend then to call for certain actions in your character. And I believe if we would, at the very least, start speaking more respectfully of God, that would help us eventually to start thinking more reverently of God. We'll look at some passages with you that relate to that general point. In Ecclesiastes chapter 5, the writer talks about the fact that we need to be careful before we promise we're going to do something and we call God as a witness to honor that commitment. The taking of a vow or the making of a promise with God as our witness. Ecclesiastes 5 verse 1, he says, "Walk prudently when you go to the house of God, and draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they do evil. Do not be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart utter anything hastily before God. For God is in heaven, and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. For a dream comes through much activity, and a fool's voice is known by his many words. When you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it. For he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. It is better not to vow than to vow and not pay." So verse 6, "Do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the work of your hands? For in the multitude of dreams and many words there is also vanity, but fear God." Solomon is saying a good deal here. He be the writer of Ecclesiastes. He's saying, number one, that we need to not say as many words as we say about God. It's a serious thing to talk even about the subject of God. And I'm afraid sometimes we bandy about arguments. We talk about God and debate things about God as if it were just a game, just a fun little exercise that Really, nothing's at stake here. This is just an interesting topic to talk about. But listen, it's a serious thing to use the gift of language to speak even about God. And so one step that we could take, if we're going to be more reverent in regard to God, have a deeper respect for Him, is to be more circumspect when it comes to what we say even about God. When we start to open our mouth to say something about God, we need to push the pause button and say, am I sure that's true? And am I sure that needs to be said? And am I going to say that respectfully of God? As religious people, we talk a lot about God. And I'm afraid we sometimes do that too casually, with too little respect for the profound reverence that that subject ought to be surrounded with, even in our thinking. And certainly when it comes to saying what we're going to do, God is my witness, I'm going to do this. We put it in the form of a vow, or we just bind our promise with God as our witness. It's a serious thing to do. The writer says you better off not to do that than to do it and then not do what you said you were going to do. It's a serious thing to invoke God in any transaction. And that shouldn't be done flippantly. And I'm telling you, people call God as witness to so many flippant, casual things. At least they seem to do so in my hearing. It just shocks me at how casually people can bring God into their transactions without them really having even thought seriously about whether they're going to carry out that promise or not. Then turn over to Jude in the New Testament, the little book of Jude right before the book of Revelation. Jude verses 8, 9, and 10. Jude is talking about certain false teachers and how flippantly they would talk about God and how casually they would speak against even certain angelic powers. Likewise, verse 8, he says, these dreamers defile the flesh, reject authority, and speak evil of dignitaries. Yet Michael the archangel, in contending with the devil, when he disputed about the body of Moses, dared not bring against him a reviling accusation, but said, the Lord rebuke you. But these speak evil of what they do not know. And whatever they know naturally, like brute beasts, in these things they corrupt themselves. Woe to them, for they have gone in the way of Cain, and have run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit, and perished in the rebellion of Korah. All of those examples that he gives there are examples of people acting irreverently, with no respect to God. And he says one of the failings of these false teachers is how quickly and how casually they will bring a railing accusation against powers, maybe even evil powers, but powers so high above them that they are talking about things they don't know much about. And it's a serious thing to do that. The gift of language is a marvelous gift, but I'm telling you, we use it very carelessly sometimes, don't we? And nowhere do we commit a more serious error than when we use the gift of language to speak carelessly about spiritual realities in many cases that we know very little about. And so that calls for reserve, doesn't it, in what we say and how we say it. Rather than saying more, we'd say less, and what we do say it a lot more respectfully. Then, of course, James, in James chapter 4, talks about the problem of speaking just pridefully and pompously about what we're going to do without realizing that God may have other plans. And that a part of reverence for God is being careful before we say what we're going to do, whether we call God into the deal as our witness or not. James 4 verse 13, come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell and make a profit, whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. But now you boast in your arrogance, and all such boasting is evil. He says the attitude that doesn't believe God needs to be taken into account is an arrogant attitude. It's boasting. And you say, I'm going to do this, you're saying something that you really have no control about. You're promising more than you have the power to deliver on. God will have some say about whether you bring that to pass or not. And to speak carelessly about what we're going to do without deferring to God's will is disrespectful at the very least. It's failing to bow before the throne of His sovereignty and to make our plans contingent on whether it's His will for us to do what we say we're going to do. I mentioned Brother Gary Fisher in a lesson, I believe, last week. A good friend of mine, Gary, goes to Brazil preaching two or three or four times a year. He used to live in Brazil doing the Lord's work. Still goes back frequently. And he said, many of the brethren in Brazil are just almost obsessed with this idea of saying with every statement, if the Lord wills, we'll do this or that. And he said, for a while it was irritating to him. He said, he agrees with the principle, but he didn't believe you have to say that after every statement that you make. But he said, the Brazilian brethren really do. And he said, he many times be down there and not disrespectfully, but just say, well, tomorrow morning I'm going to do this. And he said, the Brazilian brethren say, if the Lord wills, you'll do that. But maybe not, if the Lord has other plans. And he said, it's been a healthy reminder to him to have them remind him at every turn of the conversation that God has a will, and respect means deferring to that will and recognizing that ultimately the thing that matters is His will and not ours. Those three passages, Ecclesiastes 5 and Jude and James chapter 4, I think are just examples, three examples out of many more that could be multiplied in the Bible, of situations in life where this issue of reverence comes up. Reverence is a whole lot more than just not taking the Lord's name in vain. We show irreverence in our words in a lot more ways than when we're cursing and swearing. There'd be a great sermon that could be preached about the wrongfulness of that, but I'm just trying to illustrate to you that by many of the kinds of ways that we talk on an everyday basis, we betray the fact that we just don't defer to God as we ought to. Real reverence, if we're going to try to recover a sense of real reverence, it's far more than just a feeling, isn't it? It's an attitude. It's a character trait involving several things. Ultimately, the greatest respect that you can show to God is to do what? Obey His will. Say whatever else you want to about reverence, but if you are a disobedient person, whatever disobedience there is in your life, that's irreverence. That's why it's sinful. Because it's a saying to God, I'm going to do what I want to do. I don't care what you want to do. It's a slapping God's face every time we deliberately disobey what we know He has said for us to do. So we want to start becoming a more reverent people. We need to start becoming a more obedient people. I wish that I could get folks to understand. Maybe I need to understand this more myself, and that would help. But I think we need to understand that the matter of obedience goes far beyond the question of whether we're going to agree to the specific do's and don'ts of the Scripture. The Scripture says, thou shalt not murder. If I go out and murder somebody, that's a flagrant disregard of a specific command not to do something. And that's obviously disobedience. So when I say we need to be a more obedient people, a lot of people think, well, I don't think of any way that I'm deliberately defying any specific black and white command, and so I'm an obedient person. Well, maybe yes and maybe no. Obedience goes a lot beyond the specific thou shalt and thou shalt not. Most of the decisions that you'll have to make tomorrow about whether to obey God or not won't involve specific commands, will they? They'll be in situations where the Lord won't have specifically said what He wants you to do or not do. Maybe they won't even involve right and wrong. They may just involve good, better, and best. You know, which path would the Lord prefer me to follow here? So when Paul says in Ephesians chapter 5, we need to understand, not be foolish, but understand the will of the Lord, he's not just talking about the specific commands. He's talking about in every situation, at every fork in the road where I'm going to have to decide, am I going to do this or am I going to do that? The Christian will want to do whatever he believes the Lord would want him to do. And I'll tell you, the last 3 months, really, as I've been wrestling with decision about whether to make any changes in my work, that has been a very practical issue with me. I don't think any of the alternatives that I might consider would involve specific right or wrong. But if I stand at any kind of a fork in the road or any kind of crossroads, I need to have the assurance that the fork in the road that I've taken is the one that the Lord would want me to take, knowing that he hasn't specifically sent me a telegram to say, this is what I want you to do. But I've got to be concerned about what would the Lord prefer me to do, even if it's a choice between good, better, and best. And if I, after having evaluated a situation, I know which alternative the Lord would prefer me to take, and I deliberately do otherwise, that's disobedience. That's deliberately saying, Lord, I know what you'd rather me do, but I'd rather do this. And if that's not saying my will be done, I don't know what is. Obedience and reverence means deferring to the Lord's will in every decision I make, as best I'm able to determine what I know he would want me to do. And the more you walk with the Lord, the more you saturate your mind in his word and you imbibe his character, the easier it is for you to know what he'd rather you do in any situation. Just like the longer you live with your spouse, the easier it is to know if you faced a choice which they would prefer you to do without even talking to them about that, because you know them. You've learned their character. Well, as we learn the character of God, the farther we go in life, the easier it is for us to discern what he would want us to do. And reverence means doing that, yielding to his will, saying, Lord, what wilt thou have me to do? What can I do that would be pursuing the highest road possible here? Not what do I want to do and can I rationalize that as being okay with the Lord, but what would the Lord's will for me be? And how may I reverently bow before that, whether that's what I want to do or not? Certainly, reverence has a lot to do with our speech. And I'm afraid the word God and the word Lord has become such common coinage. People throw those words around so flippantly, it's just shocking sometimes, isn't it, to see how casually people speak, even about the most serious subject in the world, let alone the most powerful being in the universe, God himself. There needs to be a greater reserve, if I may use that word, greater reserve in how we speak about God, and listen to me, how we speak to God. Think about public prayer, for example. What's happening in this assembly, this room, when somebody comes to the microphone and leads us in prayer? What's going on there? Well, we are all praying, or should be, but what's happening is we've asked somebody to be our spokesman before the throne of God, to speak for us on behalf of the group. If all of us as a group are going to go to Washington to petition the president about something, and we got permission for the entire congregation at Broadmoor to come to Washington and be ushered into the White House to make our request, all of us couldn't speak. Somebody has to be designated as the spokesman to present the group's request on behalf of the group. And that's what's happening in public prayer. We've asked someone to be our spokesman before the throne of God, to make our requests for us, to speak our desires for us. And at the end, if we say amen, that means we agree with what he said. Yes, that is a reflection of what we desire from God and what we wish to say to him. If you're going to be the spokesman of a group of people before the throne of God, if God were physically visible and present in this room tonight, and we asked somebody, would you present our request to God? You think that person would be respectful? They'd be careful in what they say? They'd be reserved in their language? I believe they would be. But no less than that's going on when we pray privately. We are appearing before the throne of the Creator of the universe. That's not a time to be flippant. Yes, I know God, Hebrews 4 teaches us that we can come boldly before the throne of grace, knowing that He's our Father and He wants to hear our petitions. But He's not just our Father, He's our God. When we speak to Him, we need to speak reverently and respectfully, and I think with a certain reserve. We sometimes can be just real chatterboxes, can't we, when we're in God's hearing, and we need to work on our respect. Certainly, reverence involves worship, doesn't it? We want to be a more reverent people. We need to learn to be a more worshipful people, to learn more about praise and adoration. And those things really mean what? They simply mean expressing our reverence to God. Worship means acknowledging our deep attitude of reverence to Him. It says so much about the times in which we live, doesn't it, that so many people anymore think of worship as basically entertainment. Talking to somebody not too long ago who had visited the assembly of a congregation of the Lord's people in another city. They were not a member of the Lord's church, but they had visited at the invitation of one of the members of that congregation. And so I asked them how they liked it, what their impression was. And they said, well, it was pretty boring. They said, where I go to church, we have a band and we rock. and they said, your service is pretty tame, pretty uninteresting. Well, they're speaking as a very modern person who come to think that when we come to an assembly, we come to be pleased. The whole object of this is to please us. So we go away saying, well, that was great. I enjoyed that. Or that sends me away feeling like I want to feel about myself. Well, that's not what worship is. In worship, somebody said, God is the audience. We are before His throne, speaking to Him, worshiping Him. And basically, when you boil it all down, worship means, either verbally or in our actions that He's commanded us to engage in, that we are reflecting reverence. It's simply a way of outwardly expressing the deep respect and even godly fear that we have for Him. And when worship is not worshipful, how can we call it worship? You've heard me speak in other lessons about the importance of rightly relating ourselves to God's glory, and I think that's a part of reverence. By that I mean that whatever the requirements of God's glory are, if we are reverent, we will yield to those, whatever that might mean for us. It's not a matter of what we want. This is not about us. Worship and reverence are about God, and a part of reverence means being willing to yield to whatever the needs of God's glory might be, as Paul said in Philippians chapter 1, when he contemplated whether he was going to live or die at the hands of the Roman government. And he said, I really only want that Christ will be magnified in my body, whether by life or by death. It doesn't matter to me whether they put me to death or whether I continue to live, as long as I know that's the thing that will most greatly glorify the Lord. Well, there's a reverent attitude. Person who says, I only want that Christ to be glorified, even if that requires the chopping off of my head, I only want that God be glorified. That's reverence right there. I think there's also a lot that to be said, and I won't say a lot because our time is almost up tonight, but a lot to be said on the subject of reverence for setting an example of reverence for other people. I'm afraid sometimes we don't, even as the Lord's people, inculcate respect in the hearing and in the sight of those with whom we have to deal. It just is increasingly on my awareness the older I get that I just hope that when my life is over and people reflect back upon their interaction with me, the very worst thing that could happen, as far as I'm concerned, is that people would look back at their interaction with me and say, you know, I took God less seriously as a result of my dealings with Gary Henry. I hope just the opposite could be said. It would satisfy me if nothing else could be said about me when I pass away, except that Gary Henry inculcated a deep respect for God. And whatever dealings I had with him, I came away having a deeper reverence for God. I don't know of any bigger favor we can do people that we have to dealings with than in our dealings with them to set an example of reverence, and so that they ultimately be able to say, you know, I took God more seriously after dealing with that person, rather than having to say, my dealings with that person, they rubbed off on me, and I cared less about God than I did to start with. Paul wrote to the Thessalonians, 1 Thessalonians chapter 1. He indicated that they were having that kind of an effect on other people. Their reverence and their concern for God was setting example even for people very far away. 1 Thessalonians 1, verse 8, from you the word of the Lord has sounded forth, not only in Macedonia and Achaia, but also in every place. Your faith toward God has gone out, so that we do not need to say anything. For they themselves declare concerning us what manner of entry we had to you, and how you turned to God from idols to serve the living and true God, and to wait for his Son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead, even Jesus, who delivers us from the wrath to come. That's the kind of example that we ought to want to have on those that we have dealings with. Well, reverence is a part of integrity and wholeness. When sin came into our lives, sin tends to break things apart. It has a divisive, fracturing kind of an effect. When sin enters the picture, it just smashes everything. Being forgiven of sins and brought back into a right relationship with God is the process of putting everything back together. And I don't doubt that when we get to heaven and everything has been put back together, we've completely regained the wholeness that we had before sin. Now we have integrity. Now there's no inconsistencies or any brokenness in our life. Everything is back together in unity as it ought to be. Won't it be obvious that that wholeness in heaven will largely consist in the fact that we've come back to true reverence? In heaven, there won't be any reverence issues, will there? We will have learned again to properly relate ourselves in respect and reverence to God. And it would be obvious to us at that time that's a big part of why in this life we struggled with a lack of integrity and a lack of wholeness, is that we were leaving reverence out of the picture. You want more peace of mind and more unity within you. You want to be a more whole person? I suggest the most practical step you can take about that is to start taking God more seriously. More reverent. Put that back in place, and a lot of other the broken pieces will take care of themselves. So let me conclude by reading some words from Paul in Titus chapter 2. To kind of make that point. Titus chapter 2, verse 11. Speaking of the effects that the gospel has. The grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men, teaching us, here's what the gospel teaches us, that denying ungodliness and worldly lust, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in the present age, looking for the blessed hope and glorious appearing of our great God and Savior Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us that he might redeem us from every lawless deed and purify for himself his own special people, zealous for good works. So Paul says to Titus, speak these things, exhort and rebuke with all authority, let no one despise you. Preaching the gospel ultimately is the preaching of the respect and the reverence that God ought to receive from us. And the practical commands of the gospel are simply specific commands where God is saying, this is how I want you to show respect for me. To the extent that we can come back to reverence in this life, we'll be getting a foretaste of what heaven's going to be like, where our attitude about that will once again be exactly what it ought to be. We're going to sing now in just a moment the song that David has announced as an invitation song, and we want to use that as an opportunity to invite obedience to the gospel. Maybe somebody here tonight that needs to take some public step in obedience to the gospel. Maybe you've never become a Christian at all. That certainly is a public step, requiring that we confess our faith and be baptized into Christ. But maybe you are a Christian, and there's some public step you need to take that involves publicly asking for the prayers and the concern and the encouragement of your brethren. whatever may be your need, we hope that you won't just take this as another opportunity, and I'll have many more just like this, so I don't need to worry about it right now. There's some need that we can help you with that has to do with God. Respect for God would say, whatever else is on my to-do list, I need to take care of this before I do anything else. If we can help you with it, won't you come while we stand and sing the invitation song?
Jesus will give.